Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin.
What does it mean to be American?
Thanks for joining us for episode 22 of our ongoing series, Democracy Optimist. The series is hosted by Joshua Douglas at the University of Kentucky Rosenberg College of Law, where he researches and stays on top of election law, voting, and constitutional issues. You can find all of our Democracy Optimist episodes online at esweku.org. Go to the Contributors and Series tab, and you'll get a drop-down menu where you'll find Democracy Optimist. This latest episode is all about the glue that holds together our democracy. It's forever developing, expanding, retreating, working well for some, not so well for others, but it's the thing that has made America a global beacon of freedom and hope. Listen now as Josh brings us conversations with two people who work hard at keeping us engaged and active.
As listeners of this show will surely know, I'm a huge proponent of stronger civics education. People hear the phrase civics education, and they often think of a K-12 class in government. States have enacted laws that require high school students to be able to pass the same citizenship test that new citizens must take. But is that the right approach? And what can we do to ensure civics is not just something we discuss briefly in school, but instead is a lifelong endeavor? Today's guest might have some answers. Donna Cohen is a former educator and librarian in Oregon. She runs a program called Civics for Adults, which includes interactive, in-person or virtual workshops that provide nonpartisan information about the political process and civic engagement. You can find her at www.civicthinker.info. Donna, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
Thank you for inviting me, Josh. I'm happy to be here.
So your website, as I mentioned, civicthinker.info, opens with a quote from Justice Louis Brandeis. He says, quote, "The most important political office is that of the private citizen." What do you think Justice Brandeis meant by this quote, and why is it at the top of your website?
Well, I love that quote. Democracy, of course, means self-government, and that's the public. So if we are not engaged, if we are not part of the process, it's not actually democracy. And I think the quote basically captures that. And that's what I try to do in my workshops.
Yeah. So let's talk about these workshops, Civics for Adults. How did you start it? What's the origin story here?
Well, a few years ago, I realized that I was very interested in a variety of civics topics. That as a librarian, I was very good at research. Having been a teacher, I felt that I was in a position to be able to present these topics. And the main thing is I just felt that there was a really strong need for civics education for adults. So I basically put it all together and just started to do it. And I've been going at this for 9 years, and it's been quite successful.
That's really interesting. And I think one of the things you're tapping into is that we talk about public health. We had COVID, and there's often, you know, lots of discussions about public health. But I think we have an epidemic of civic health as well. And, you know, you see these surveys of the number of people who can name the three branches of government or, you know, who can name the justices on the Supreme Court or their member of Congress. Are those the right questions to ask in addressing the civic health epidemic we have?
Yes, but it's incredibly incomplete. For example, we know that maybe half of the public do not realize that if there's a disagreement between the Supreme Court and the president, that the Supreme Court has the last word on the interpretation of the Constitution. That's a really important thing for people to know, for example, right now. So there are some basic knowledge pieces that we have to have, but it has to go way beyond that. A few years ago, our city club here in Portland did a civics ed study, and they said there were three things needed for, you know, being a good citizen, being engaged. One of them was basic knowledge of how the government works and some history. also critical thinking skills. And so that's one of my workshops. And then lastly, the disposition to want to be engaged. So my four workshops basically encompass those three areas, which I think together make the difference and encourage people to be good citizens.
So let's talk a little bit more about those workshops. As you mentioned, there's four, one on misinformation and propaganda, another on citizen activism, a third about the Constitution itself, and fourth about elections. Those last two, as a law professor of voting rights and constitutional law, are particularly interesting to me. Tell us what you specifically do in these workshops. I know they last longer than the time we have for our conversation, but just give us a brief overview. What do these workshops actually look like?
Okay, in the misinformation workshop, it's all based on examples from online posts, from emails, poll questions, deep fakes. I use real-world examples, and I explain and ask the workshop participants, especially if we're doing it in person, what they see, and then I explain what's actually going on there. And a couple of the principles that really underline that workshop, one is, well, I like to say a claim without substantiation is just an opinion. In other words, where's the evidence? We have an epidemic of people who make claims constantly, and this is online, this is politicians, even reporters a lot of times, just people making claims as though it were fact. And the thing is, we need to push for what's your evidence. So that's one of the most important things. Another principle of that workshop is, what's missing? Do you have all the information you need to actually make a judgment? Because so often we are given part of information. We're given information out of context. We're given just incomplete information. So we need to always be looking to make sure we have everything we need. The activism workshop really is very practically oriented. We talk about the structure of government and the different levels of government, because one of the key things is just going to the right level of government if you want to see change. There's no sense in going to the state legislature if you want a pothole fixed, for example. So we talk about ways to engage. A lot of people don't realize you can go to your city council or your county commission, and there's usually a time just for a citizen or a resident to just say what they want about something. They might have 2 or 3 minutes. There are boards and commissions and stakeholder committees that people can be on that are just volunteer opportunities, but can be very, very powerful. So, for example, in Portland, we radically changed our structure of our government this year. And those recommendations that we voted on came from a group of volunteer citizens that met for 2 years. So that can be a very powerful way to be involved. Your legislature, I gave testimony a couple of weeks ago down at the state legislature, and we can do that virtually now. So that's wonderful. There are bills in state legislatures that affect everybody's lives. In the elections workshop, we talk about how, you know, voting rights, voter suppression. We talk about alternative voting systems, which are now in parts of the country becoming more popular, ranked choice voting, for example. We talk about gerrymandering. And then I show how to use the campaign finance database from our state. So that's what we covered there. And then, although I love all my workshops, the one I'm most excited about right now is the one that I've renamed Representation, Our Federal Government and the Constitution. So we do talk about the creation of the Constitution, and there are a lot of myths around that that we sort of blow away, and a bit about then how it developed and the Bill of Rights. But then I spend a lot of time now on the concept of representation and the ways that our federal government, through the Constitution, is not as representative as the framers originally intended, and the reasons why that is, and the makeup of the House and the Senate and the Electoral College and so forth. And I think when people understand that it's a lot of times our problems stem, in my opinion, from structural issues, not the people involved. I mean, sometimes we have people that aren't helpful to our democracy, but a lot of times it's really structural. So just an example would be primaries. I know in Oregon, and I think this is typical, a lot of places, a lot of people, something like 40% of voters in Oregon are unaffiliated with a party and they don't vote in primaries. Well, it's kind of hard to feel connected to your government if you can't vote in a primary. So anyways, we talk about some of these structural changes that we should be considering that would, I think, make people feel more connected and have more of a stake and just feel more represented.
Which might also help to fix the turnout problem that we have.
Yes.
You know, not only do we have, in my view, low turnout in, you know, the presidential election when everyone's paying attention, but sometimes those primaries really determine who the winner, ultimate winner is in many places because of gerrymandering or otherwise. And those are, you know, very low turnout. So, you know, when I talk to people about civics education, I'm guessing many of them wouldn't necessarily be excited about going to sit in on what sounds like a class, you know, if they're not already in school, you know, a class on or a workshop on civics education. So how do you encourage people to go and how do you make it fun?
Well, it is fun and it is interesting based upon the reactions I get from people who do come. So people are very clear that they really enjoy the workshops. They enjoy it because they're gaining knowledge that they find useful, that they didn't have, that we have a give and take. It is true that a lot of people, you know, it's like civics, oh, what's civics, a constitution or whatever. So it's something that's sort of taken some time for people to realize. I mean, I have sort of followers now that are sort of want to know when, you know, when is my next workshop? Because they've taken one and then they see how interesting it is and then they want to continue. I have some people who've taken them multiple times. I mean, even the same workshop. But as far as getting folks, the libraries or the sponsor, whoever has contracted with me to do workshop, have primary responsibility for publicity. And then I have an email list. I have a website. I have a Facebook group. So people find out from there, too.
Civics education is often seen these days in our polarized political environment as a partisan issue. Often you hear that's the left that wants, you know, more and better civics education. So how do you make sure that these workshops aren't seen as political? And how do we get away from that idea that improving civics education is not a partisan ploy?
It's certainly not partisan. We see people from all political persuasions being involved. We see people in town halls in, you know, Republican states and in Democratic states. So we see people are involved. I had a woman one time who came up to me afterwards. She said, I'm not sure we voted the same way, but I really like what you did, you know. And in another workshop, a constitutional workshop I did one time, people were quite pleased. But I had one person who thought I was too far to the right and one person who thought I was too far to the left. So I figure I'm, you know, hitting the right spot then. So I don't think this has to be seen as partisan. It is basic knowledge about how your government works, how you can engage with your government, right? And critical thinking skills. And all of those things are nonpartisan.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I think you espouse a lot as a former librarian are the structures to get that education out into the world. I know that we talked about how you believe libraries are vital institutions for our communities. And libraries, you told me over email, are kind of vital to democracy. So, you know, what do you mean by that? And especially in the current environment where we're seeing cuts to public institutions like libraries, funding cuts, how do we navigate that issue in today's world?
I can't think of an institution that is more open and welcoming, friendly, you know, knowledgeable, a space for everybody That's the thing about libraries that's so wonderful. But it is true that libraries are having a tough time. And I know there are libraries that at times have questioned whether they should invite me or have not invited me, because even though they know that I am nonpartisan, they're afraid it might be seen as a partisan thing.
Mm-hmm. Are you optimistic about democracy, about voting and elections? And how can we stay optimistic right now?
That's a really great question. So one of the things that I do, the first thing I do in my activism workshop is I go back to the Gilded Age and I talk about how difficult things were then for so many people. And yet we got past that. When I was a kid and I took history in public school, I hated it. I hated it because I don't have a really good memory and it was all about dates and stuff. And so, you know, now though, I have a whole different appreciation for history, because if you can understand the way things were, especially when there are some difficult times and how we got past them, it can give you hope for other times. And I think that we have to look at those lessons, see what worked and what helped, and do a lot of those same things and more. And so I'm optimistic in the sense that if people become aware of what we need to do for our democracy, then, yeah, we can reach a better point than we have in the past. I mean, we had a civil war. Right? We went through, women couldn't vote. We had the civil rights era. We've been through a lot of difficult times. So we have to remember that. And that's where really knowing something about history can be really helpful.
So I often ask guests, what's the one thing that listeners can do to support democracy? I'm guessing your answer will be take your workshop. And we'll mention in a moment how people can learn more about them. Is there anything else that you would advise listeners to do if they're not in Oregon or they aren't able to do the virtual workshop that you offer?
One thing that I have noticed, and I've read about, but I've also noticed personally, is that people who are engaged, right, in their communities and trying to do things, trying to improve things, tend to be more optimistic than people who are not engaged and who just sort of sit back and see things that they don't like and, you know, complain about them. So I would say look for something in your local community that you can work on. There are a lot of opportunities and the county and state level. But I mean, I worked on a transportation project for 11 years in my local community. It was a life and death issue. It took a lot of work, but we did win. And when you do that, when you get involved and see that you can make some change on, you know, a more local level, it gives you more faith. And the one other thing is I would try to tune in to some of the structural changes that people are working on, whether it's primaries or independent redistricting commissions or proportional representation. Look at some of those, you know, find the people in your communities that are working on making those structural changes.
Tell us, Donna, how people can find about you and your workshops.
Okay, well, my website is really helpful, civicthinker.info, and also a Facebook page, and the link is on the website.
Donna Cohen runs workshops called Civics for Adults, and you can find her and the workshop information at civicthinker.info. Donna, thank you so much for joining Democracy Optimist.
Thank you, Josh. It was a pleasure.
Josh, at the beginning of your conversation with Donna Cohen, you quoted Justice Louis Brandeis as saying, "The most important political office is that of the private citizen." Do you think that generally we don't think of ourselves as citizens as important to the process and kind of tend to think of civics as something that's just for government people and politicians?
I think that we don't think of our need to engage on a daily basis as citizens. I mean, many of us do go and vote, not enough of us, but many of us do go and vote, whether it's in, you know, local elections or the presidential elections. But we don't really think about the need to be a civically minded citizen on the other days. And you know, living in a democracy is not a once every 4 year endeavor. And that's what I really love about what Donna Cohen is doing with her workshops, is she's reminding people that being an important contributor to democracy is something that we can do all year round.
You know, in my travels, I occasionally run across people who are just checked out. They just feel that their bandwidth has been challenged to the limit. So why should they care? What are the dangers of failing to keep yourself informed about what's going on in the civics life of your community or your country?
Yeah, I think we see this a lot. People are busy, right? And that's why I asked her, how do you keep these things fun and engaging? Because you're right, it's so easy to just sort of, you know, let say, you know, the people in Washington are going to figure this out and I can have no influence whatsoever. And so I think one aspect to remember is that this does matter. It has an effect on your everyday life. You know, she mentioned, what happens if you have a pothole on your street? Do you actually know who to call to get that fixed? What happens, you know, when prices of goods get higher? Who do you call to say this is not okay and we need to change the current approach to economic policy? These do have impacts. And so I think the more we can make the conversation about, I mean, really self-interest. How are these issues going to affect your daily lives? And helping people understand that these things have an actual effect on their already busy lives is a way to help them understand that they need to be involved. And then the second thing I think we need to do is just make this stuff fun. You know, we highlighted Donna Cohen and her workshops. There's other organizations we've talked about on this show here in Kentucky, the group Civic Lex, which does really interesting, innovative programming. I love this organization I learned about recently in Denver called Warm Cookies of the Revolution. It's a nonprofit group that really makes civic engagement fun, and they bring warm cookies to all of their workshops. Maybe we'll try to get one of them on to this show to talk about that. So those sorts of things, making it real and making it fun, I think are important.
We're always willing to talk about warm cookies. After listening to Donna Cohen talk about civic engagement, what's your main takeaway from that conversation?
That people are clamoring for this information, that there is a real need out there. I mean, the one question I have still is, how are we reaching people who are kind of checked out, as you mentioned, you know, who might not feel like they have the knowledge or the desire to be involved? And I wonder how many of her workshop participants are, you know, really non-voters who think the system doesn't work for them? And how do we capture those people as well? How do we engage with those people? But to me, the number one takeaway here is that she's right. She's absolutely right that we think of civics education, when we have discussions about it, as high school courses on memorizing the three branches of government. And then once people graduate high school, we hardly ever talk about civics again. And that's why I used the term, which I think she really agreed with, of the civic health epidemic, to think about, you know, this is a problem that really plagues the concerns of voter apathy, the concerns about voter turnout, the concerns that democracy isn't really working. And one community, one workshop at a time, I think, is the way to fight back against that. I think that is the cure, or at least one of the cures, to this problem that we have.
Next on Eastern Standards Democracy Optimist.
Democracy, of course, means self-government, and that's the public. So if we are not engaged, if we are not part of the process, it's not actually democracy.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
When you support WEKU, you are making it possible to produce programs like Eastern Standard, focusing on Central and Eastern Kentucky, what the regions share in common, and what makes each distinctive. Featuring interviews by host and editor Tom Martin and a growing roster of contributors, Eastern Standard is professionally produced by sound designer and technical director Neil Kesterson. This weekly current affairs program is made possible by your support of WEKU. You can join our community of supporters by calling 800-621-8890 or contributing online at weku.org. The WEKU Daily News Podcast is now available for download. It's available weekday afternoons and includes the top five stories of the day. The WEKU News Podcast is available on the WEKU app, Apple, Spotify, and WEKU.org.
Listening to Episode 22 of Democracy Optimist, a series produced by Eastern Standard and Dynamics Productions for the listeners of WEKU. I'm Tom Martin, and in this episode, our series host, Josh Douglas, is exploring how people are working to keep us engaged in a political system and process that can often seem broken these days, which, ironically, calls for even more civic voter engagement. Here's Josh Douglas.
I've often been concerned about voter turnout. After the November 2024 election, there were numerous stories about how voter turnout was high, the second highest in the century, in fact, second only to 2020. Yet turnout nationwide was under 64%. Over one-third of eligible voters did not show up. How can we celebrate strong voter engagement or an electoral mandate when more people didn't vote than voted for the winner? But at least one state has consistently been among the top in voter turnout. Minnesota, the land of 10,000 lakes, has a strong culture of democratic engagement. Here to discuss Minnesota's success is its Secretary of State, Steve Simon. Secretary Simon is a former five-time member of the Minnesota House of Representatives and has been elected to the office of Secretary of State three times. I know he's particularly proud of his state's record on voter turnout. Secretary Simon, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about the past several elections in Minnesota. In three elections from 2016 to 2020 and years preceding, Minnesota has had the highest voter turnout in the country, often approaching 80%. What does Minnesota do to foster this kind of engagement, and what can other states learn from Minnesota?
You know, I think in explaining Minnesota's success at voter turnout, two things really stand out to me, good laws and good culture. On the law front, we have things like same day or election day voter registration. We've had that for over 50 years, which is what it sounds like. You can register on game day, on election day. There is no pre-election cutoff, as is the case in most states. You can register online. You can, if you're an eligible voter, vote from home without an excuse or explanation or doctor's note or anything like that. And we've had a number of other recent reforms and changes as well. So part of it is the legal landscape. You have to have laws in place that strike the right balance between access and security. It's both, right? We all want both. Every single American wants both. But it's how you strike that balance. And in Minnesota, while we have very vigorous security measures, we haven't let those get in the way of making voting essentially easy. You don't want it to be an obstacle course. As to culture, the second thing that I often cite in referring to a reason for our success, that's tougher to pin down, but I think it starts in schools. It starts with a business community and a nonprofit community that value voting, that convey the message consistently that voting is real, it's consequential, it's significant, that look, people get elected to all sorts of things, president of the United States, school board, everything in between, and what they do or fail to do when they get into office has real downstream effects on all of us. It's that intangible, that message conveyed that this is a real thing, it's worthy of your time and attention. That's how I would explain our success.
So let's talk a little bit more about creating that culture. You know, you mentioned the business community, the nonprofit community. How can a state that maybe doesn't see that same level of voter turnout and maybe people there don't feel like there's the same kind of culture of, hey, everyone really needs to participate. How do you go about fostering that kind of a culture?
Well, I think you have to take it in pieces. And let me just give you an example. Like, take youth turnout, okay? Let's say 18 through 24 or something like that. That's a piece that you can really work on culturally. Now, part of that is, again, laws. We just passed 2 years ago a pre-registration law that allows 16 and 17-year-olds to, in essence, get in line to register. But it's beyond just that. I think going to high schools, going even to middle schools, certainly going to colleges and universities. And I would say this in particular. I think it's very important when talking to young people about voting not to focus only and exclusively on the good deed reasons, let's call them, for voting. In other words, it's not a good idea to only say, hey, voting is a good thing to do. Voting is the right thing to do. People fought and bled and died for the right to vote, so you should vote. Those are essential reasons. It's just that we shouldn't limit ourselves to those. I think increasingly with young people, and this is the cultural piece, not at all dependent on any law passing or not passing, I think it's important to mix those good deed reasons with self-interest reasons, to say to young people, look, this isn't a blood drive. This isn't about doing a bold and selfless act that will benefit someone that you'll never meet. This is about you. Voting is good for you. Why? Because people and communities that vote tend to get more attention. And when you tend to get more attention, you tend to get more of the stuff that you want. It's not a slam dunk. It's not all the time, of course. But this idea of voting being in your self-interest, not just helping a little old lady across the street. It's not altruism. It's in your interest. That's a cultural piece as to younger voters that I think anyone, any institution can really embrace.
So Minnesota is not really considered a swing state these days, at least on the national level. And yet people there still say, you know, their vote matters. You hear this all the time, right? That there's a lot of voter apathy, right? That, you know, I don't live in a swing state. It's only the seven states that the candidates, the presidential candidates are paying attention to that are going to make a difference. So why bother? What's your response to that voter apathy aspect that I feel like we hear a lot about?
Yeah, I have several, but one that I'm fond of mentioning more than the others is, look, don't give someone an excuse to ignore you. That's what you're doing when you don't vote. They may not have even needed an excuse, but when you don't vote, you are giving those who run for office and those who hold office an excuse to ignore you. When you vote, when the community you're a part of votes, whether that's geographic, demographic, or anything else, you are going to get more attention. And you are therefore more likely to get some, most, maybe all, of the stuff that you want. So don't let others off the hook. You know, some people stay away. It's beyond apathy. It's sort of they think they're making a statement or lodging a protest of some kind. I saw a T-shirt a few years ago that said it all for me. The T-shirt said, failure to vote is not an act of rebellion. It's an act of surrender. Don't give up. Don't let others roll over you and ignore you. Stand up, step up, be a voter. And you don't have to vote for everything, by the way. I tell people that too. You know, some people are intimidated by how many contests are on the ballot. They might say there are 28 or 30 contests on this ballot, to which I say, fine, vote for what you know. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 8, 20 of the 28, whatever, and leave the rest blank. Your ballot is not spoiled. It's a secret ballot in this country. No one's ever going to know. And someday maybe you will have an opinion on all the other offices, but until that day comes, just vote for what you know.
So we're talking in part about threats to democracy, because that's kind of been a talking point a lot recently. And one of those threats is to election officials itself. I know that your office received a suspicious package before the 2024 election. Other offices received similar things. There's been election-related violence, either actual or threatened. How has that impacted your office and your work, and what should we do moving forward in response to those threats?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's had a big impact. I wish it weren't so, but it is. When I first got into this line of work, when I was first election, I would never have dreamed that we would be talking about actual physical security concerns for those who administer elections, whether it's in our office or in the counties or cities across Minnesota or anywhere in this country. Unfortunately, it seems to come with the territory these days. I wish it didn't, but it does. So what do we do about it? One is to increase partnerships up, down, and sideways, not only with those who administer elections, but with security folks in the federal government, with local sheriffs. You know, we can and we have overcome this. All it takes is good planning, good communications up, down, and sideways to make sure that people are safe and secure. Laws are a part of it. I recommend that all states have good laws that spell out very clearly who can and cannot be in a polling place. Of course, that doesn't necessarily and always guarantee security, but it goes a long way. Make sure that everyone's on the same page about what to do if there's any sort of security incident, et cetera. You know, you mentioned the packet that we and other states got last fall. Fortunately, it was a false alarm. There was white powder in that packet. It turned out to not be a harmful substance, but we had to evacuate the office anyway. But fortunately, we had good rules in place, and we had drilled and practiced this and knew what to do. So I think part of it is just getting with other partners, talking to one another, and making sure that we aren't compromised in any way by anyone's attempt to distract with either fake threats of violence or, God forbid, attack with real violence. We can do this. We just have to talk to each other.
Yeah, and we also had, right in 2024, some mail ballots, some ballot boxes that were, you know, set on fire, not in your state. So we're seeing these sort of threats. And one thing you mentioned, I think, is really interesting, is the need to talk to one another better. And that, I think, crosses partisan lines as well, in that, you know, denouncing election violence is not a partisan issue and should not be a partisan issue. And yet, in today's political climate, it seems like everything is partisan, including the way we run our elections. I often think it's, you know, talk about how it's crazy that the U.S. is the only modern democracy in which our election officials are elected with partisan hats, right? They're not elected as neutral arbiters. They're not the baseball umpires that don't have a team. They have a team, yourself included. So how do we overcome the partisanship of today's climate with respect to issues of voting rights and democracy?
Two things come to mind. One gets at what you just identified, which is the fact that I and almost all of my colleagues across the country run on a partisan ticket. So how do we, given that, convince people that we're all really being fair? I'll tell you one thing that I have done that has worked for me and worked for Minnesota. So from day one in this office, I declared, though it's not required of me, that I will not endorse any candidate for any office at any level for any reason in the state of Minnesota, period. Doesn't matter if it's a nonpartisan contest like school board, I don't do it, nor do I give money or any kind of support to any candidate for any reason at any level of office. The idea is we all have political backgrounds and identities, but the important thing culturally is to leave that at the door. Leave that at the door when you go to work. And you've got to honestly and fairly administer elections and never, ever, ever put your thumb on the scale for any particular candidate or political party. That's one thing. The other thing that gives me a sense of optimism, actually, you mentioned voter turnout and how that can be, or at least in the past, has been needlessly partisan. Well, there's some trends which I think can help overcome that tendency towards partisanship. What I'm talking about is what we've seen in, certainly in the last election cycle, but really the last couple, which is the conventional wisdom, and I'll just be blunt here, used to be that more disengaged voters, let's say, those who don't vote as regularly, tended to lean Democratic. Now there's data up and down showing that the opposite is more and more true, that disengaged occasional voters tend to be more Republican, or at least in the last election supported President Trump, which means that turnout efforts are no longer as easily stereotyped as benefiting one political party over the other. Now the case can be made that there's much more parity, that when it's talking about election turnout or voter turnout, this is not an exercise in favoring one party or another. There's a lot more parity there in terms of disengaged or occasional voters. And I think that's a good thing from the standpoint of getting less partisanship around the issue of just voter participation.
Let's talk kind of along those lines about, you know, a nonpartisan or bipartisan solution to two issues that we see a lot of discussion about. One is stolen elections, you know, or this idea that there's massive non-citizen voting. And the second is the kind of the misinformation that surrounds our elections. Let's talk about the stolen election claims and this idea that we have massive non-citizen voting and whatnot. How does Minnesota address those concerns and get people to believe in the sanctity of the election? I know Minnesota had an extremely close election that essentially decided who controls the House of Representatives in the state. And so surely there's, you know, from the losing side, these claims out there. How did you address it, and how should states address these issues? And then we'll talk about the misinformation next.
Yeah, well, I'd say broadly speaking, transparency is our friend. the more we can not just talk about, but show people the inner workings of the election system, have them be poll workers, have them come in and watch the public meetings that we have in Minnesota to test all the elections equipment in every single jurisdiction. The more they can attend post-election audits and reviews, the more they can watch and see all the checks and balances in place, the more impressed they will be and the more confident they will be in the integrity of the system. Now, you raised one interesting issue that I know is a hot button issue nationally right now. It's the allegations about non-citizens voting. I can't speak for any other state, but in Minnesota just last summer, so this is fresh, this is new, a study was done by a professor at a local law school that looked at 10 years worth of Minnesota voting from 2014 to 2024. 13.3 million voters voted during that period. He found three cases out of 13.3 million of a non-citizen actually voting in Minnesota. And now that is three too many. We all want it to be zero. Of course we do. But you got to put this in some rational perspective. And most people who hear that number and come to understand it walk away pretty impressed. That's pretty close to zero, three out of 13.3 million. So it just, I think it helps take the temperature down rather than up when it comes to some of what's being said about our elections.
And what specifically does Minnesota do to get to that number of the three out of 13 million?
Well, I think there are a lot of things. For example, the increasingly popular method of voting by mail or voting from home is one that has extra security requirements. So anyone who orders an absentee ballot in Minnesota has to provide some personal identifying information. Driver's license number, social security number, which very often will also lead to citizenship or immigration status information. And you have to return the completed ballot with that same information. Not many states do that. We do. That's one feature of security in Minnesota, which I think has put us in a really, really good place. And let's not forget that both on the federal and state level, in every state that I'm aware of, voting in an unauthorized way, whether based on citizenship, age, or anything else, is a felony. And in the case of someone who's a non-citizen, it is a deportable felony. So the stakes are extremely high for someone who wants to engage in that kind of misconduct. They're not only going to have a felony on their record, they're probably going to be booted from the country.
So let's talk about the second part of what I mentioned, this misinformation. You know, I know last year you joined a group of secretaries of state that called on Elon Musk to stop spreading election misinformation. How has increasing online information and social media impacted the information voters receive, security, and ultimately turnout? And what do we do about that?
Yeah, the information space in the year 2025 is full of mis, dis, and malinformation. And it's very frustrating to elections administrators. Things spread like wildfire that are just plainly and provably not true. It's not a matter of opinion. Anyone can have an opinion as to me or our office or our laws in Minnesota, but really demonstrable facts. And so one of the things we're doing is to stand up, step up, and speak out when it comes to these things. Our effort with respect to Elon Musk and the X platform and the Grok search feature that they have was successful. I want to give the company credit for heeding and listening to what we said and then quietly making the change that we suggested, which they had suggested certain things, the details aren't important, that weren't true. We called them out on it, and they, to their credit, made a change. And that's a good thing. So the more we can make noise about those things, the better. We just have to keep doing that. It will get attention, especially if we band together and unite. It can get results. And this is a good example of that.
So this show is called Democracy Optimist. Are you optimistic about voting in elections? And how do we stay optimistic right now?
I am. I often say that I am a long-term optimist about our democracy. In the short and medium term, there are challenges, there are threats, there are dangers. But in the long term, I am, in part because of what we've been through. Look, we just had COVID a few years ago. In 2020, we had the COVID election, which was marked not only by that pandemic, but a lot of other stressors. And it was a great big giant stress test for this country and its democracy. Now, to mention what happened in the immediate aftermath of January 6th and the storming and the attack on the U.S. Capitol. But if you zoom out, I'd say that we not only passed that stress test, I'd say we aced it overall. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't a lot of disturbing things that still linger from that time. But we know that we've been able to overcome challenges in the past. I think we can again. I think the courts already have shown recently that they're willing to embrace the rule of law, regardless of who appointed a particular judge or what their personal political affiliation may have been in the past. We've seen the courts really stand up, as we did in the aftermath of 2020. So that's a good thing. And I think people, just everyday people, are a lot smarter and wiser about this stuff than they were just a few years ago. And that's because so many of us are making noise about it. We're talking about it. We're having conversations with people. We're pressing the issue and we're meeting the challenges. So I think it's all about continuing to embrace what we know works, continuing to stand by the rule of law, continuing to seek that balance between security and access when it comes to elections, and always, always debunking myths and disinformation. That's the way we're going to sustain what we have in America from the standpoint of democracy.
Final question for you, Secretary Simon. What is one thing listeners can do to support democracy?
It's hard to say what one thing is. I would say get involved, of course, by voting. Don't let those who are trying to make you apathetic or make you suspicious or make you even hostile to democracy, don't let them win. Keep voting. I think that's the key thing. And also draw attention to disinformation when you see it. Draw attention to things that seem to violate the law. Active citizens, whether it's through voting or others, that's what's going to carry the day for us. That's is what's going to be the secret of our success.
Steve Simon is the Secretary of State of Minnesota. Secretary Simon, thank you so much for joining us on Democracy Optimist.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Josh, you just talked with the Minnesota Secretary of State, Steve Simon, and he had a lot to say about election turnout. Minnesota has had a very high turnout in recent years. What in your mind stands out about that?
I think what he discussed with respect to the combination of laws and cultures is really interesting. We kind of already know that various policies help to create higher turnout. You know, he talked about same day voter registration, where voters can show up to the polls on election day, register and vote at the same time. And we know that states that have that policy have much higher turnout than, for example, states like Kentucky with a 29 day voter registration deadline. That is, you have to be on the rolls 29 days before election day. What I think is new, however, is his discussion of culture, about, you know, businesses and nonprofits. All are in this enterprise of encouraging people to turn out, and not just because it's the right thing to do, but because it actually matters. So that cultural aspect is something I think we need to think about more and study more and figure out how do we create that democratic culture throughout the country.
Let me ask you about that same day registration idea. Does that place a heavy burden on an election office to handle that on the day of?
Well, not really. And a bunch of states have this policy. I think it's about a third of the states that do so. It's not that everyone is registering on election day, because they still have the ability to go online and register to vote. You still have the ability to do, in many states, you know, voter registration drives and submit the voter registration documents. So it's just for the people who have not done one of those steps that they can go to the polls. And essentially, you have a separate line at the polling place for people who need to register. And it's, you know, pretty quick and simple. So, yes, there's a little bit of work to create the infrastructure for that to happen. But in terms of election day, I mean, we don't see massive lines in Minnesota or the other states that do this. They've figured out how to do it. And, you know, Minnesota's been doing it for decades.
Well, what did Secretary Simon have to say about perceptions that election officials are partisan, so they can't be fully trusted to run fair vote counts?
You know, I liked how he acknowledged that openly as a potential problem. He mentioned how that, you know, he has said he will not donate to candidates, he will not endorse candidates, and that's a good first step. I do think we need, on a broader scale, to think about finding a way to get the partisanship out of the title. Now, let me say, I think virtually all election officials do their jobs in a really nonpartisan way, where they're just focused on the combination of voter turnout and election security and running a free and fair election. It's really the perception that's the problem here, not the reality of partisanship. So we should talk about finding ways to change the election structure so they're not partisan elected officials. But even if they continue to be, I think some of the steps he's taking are good and really acknowledging it, not hiding behind the partisanship of the office, but saying, look, when I'm doing this job, when I'm in this office, my partisan hat simply comes off.
Threats to election officials are a big concern these days. What are they doing in Minnesota to keep people safe?
Yeah, that's a really big concern. I thought it was interesting that Secretary Simon acknowledged that this is something he never thought he'd have to deal with whatsoever. I do think it's a law enforcement problem. Increasing the penalties for intimidating election officials would be a very good step. And I know Minnesota has done some of that. Having various systems and protocols in place. So, you know, if you get a suspicious package, everyone knows what to do and what, you know, what's expected of them. You know, having more attention to the problem and also making sure that no matter what one's political beliefs, no matter where you are on the ideological spectrum, you denounce this. You know, we should simply not have a system where those who run our elections are fearful for their safety. That is absolutely not what American democracy should be about or is about. And we all need to denounce it no matter where it happens and no matter to whom it happens.
Well, you just talked to Secretary Simon, so it may be unfair to put you on the spot, but what is your takeaway from the conversation?
My takeaway is that, you know, a person who is running elections is still very much a democracy optimist. You know, he and I spoke before we started the formal interview about how he loves the name of the show, Democracy Optimist. In this time when so many people feel like there's threats to the system and threats to American democracy from all sorts of places and all over the ideological spectrum, he's someone who really embraces the fact of democracy as still working. And even through the COVID election of 2020, even through the political turmoil of the 2024 election, he's come out of it and said, yes, we still have a system that's beautiful, that works, and that can continue to work so long as we're intentional about ensuring its vitality.
Josh Douglas, election law and voting research professor at the University of Kentucky and host of Democracy Optimist, a special Eastern Standard series with a title that speaks for itself. Thanks for listening. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer. Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director. Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. You can find all of the interviews from this week's edition online at esweku.org. And while you're there, you can check out our archive, our contributors and their interviews, and you can sign up for our newsletter. You can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and podcast versions on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.